It's the Truepenny Show with your host, James Truepenny.
Hello and welcome to the Truepenny Show. My name is James Truepenny. This is my show, and today I am joined by the impeccable Mr. Alex Edwards of No Fix Wrestling Abroad. How are you, sir?
I'm not too bad. I've never been described as impeccable before, so I'm liking that.
Impeccable. I was looking for a new adjective. I'm like probably saying that the wrong way. Noun? Adjective? Yeah, be adjective. More describing words to give better kind of introductions to our guests. And this week, we're taking a bit of a different look. We kind of promised that we would look at different things in the Japanese wrestling culture this year, and we wouldn't just stick to New Japan like we normally do and do the odd show from history and stuff. We were going to do something different. And our first adventure down this road is to look at some big Japan pro wrestling, which happened over Wrestle Kingdom weekend. And there's a couple of shows on the Paresa Dream Google Drive we thought would be very interesting to watch. So what's your first thoughts of BJW, Alex, when you think of BJW?
Well, when I first think of it, I think of death matches and barbed wire and light tubes and just violence. And I think, right, that's not something I want to watch, so let's avoid that. But it's a new year, and, you know, you just said for the show, we're looking to expand our horizons a bit. And personally, I'm looking to expand my horizons a bit.
Yeah.
And try and view a wider range of wrestling of all different types. And so I thought this would be the perfect opportunity to try something I wouldn't usually watch. So we've got this show. We've got Big Japan Pro Wrestling's Deathmatch Kings.
Yes.
And actually, it was a lot better than I expected. Well, and it was a lot more actually fit with what I would normally watch, which I was surprised about.
Okay, we should explain BJW. If no one's ever heard of BJW before, Big Japan Pro Wrestling started in the late 1990s. It was the mid-1990s, 1995, and it kind of happened in the same period as the growth of FMW and Wing and IWA, and it was kind of lumped in with those deathmatch companies. They were started by former AJPW wrestlers Shinji Kojaki and Kendo Nagasaki, not the British Kendo Nagasaki, no, the other Kendo Nagasaki, who trained at the who worked at the dungeon and helped train a bunch of people there. But anyway, Shinji Kojaki and Kendo Nagasaki, who were, again, Kojaki is still the president of the company some 24 years later, they had a bit more of a business brain to them necessarily than the IWA and the Wing guys. Because they've been around for 24 years and they clearly didn't. And basically, it boiled down to this. They kind of like didn't have the budget to go with big exploding double hell bomb death matches. So they got kind of creative with what they were doing with their death matches. And they made death matches a bit more simple and a bit more streamlined and concentrated more on character development and solid wrestling base. And because they're AJPW guys, of course, everything's kind of King's Road style, and they built around that. And it kind of proves that King's Road style is the best kind of thing for this deathmatch kind of environment, because it's, you know, it's a similar kind of philosophy, even though Giant Baba's probably spinning in his grave at me saying that.
I mean, no, I can see what you mean, though.
Yeah.
The whole idea of building upon and hitting the bigger move, or in this case, using the more destructive weapon.
Yeah.
And it works.
It works. So it's like, it's a really good format for kind of ultra-violence matches. But BJW wasn't quite as ultra-violent. Now, they did have some kind of like moments in their day. For instance, Sabu, when he walked out on New Japan Wrestling, walked out to go to a contract with Big Japan Pro Wrestling, which is hilarious at the time, because about four people were watching Big Japan Pro Wrestling in 1995 when that happened. It was more to do with the fact that Sabu didn't want to work for New Japan anymore, despite the fact he was their junior heavyweight champion. Anywho,
well then.
Yeah, he like beat Jushin Liger in the Tokyo Dome or something ridiculous like that, and then walked out on the company because they weren't treating him fairly.
That is such a Sabu thing to do.
But he did go to Big Japan. They did have a couple of big names who were between contracts, but generally they kind of think in their homegrown core style, their homegrown core guys, their roster is pretty good at what they do. And it's nowadays, it's split into two rosters. So you have the Big Japan Deathmatch roster, Deathmatch BJ roster, as they call it. And that's people like Abdullah Kobayashi, Jackie Numazawa, Ryu Ito, who have a a reputation in hardcore wrestling, and that's the kind of thing that they want to do. And then in Strong BJ, which is kind of like more of a strong style kind of division, you have people like Daichi Hashimoto, Daisuke Sekimoto, Ryota Hama, Yasufumi Nakanui, who have a reputation for being just good, solid wrestlers. And they also have a strong junior division with people like Kazuki Hashimoto, Tatsuki Yoshino. Those guys are pretty good at what they do. And to strengthen them, they have a bunch of freelancers, so people like Onroyo from 666 and Shinobi from 666 and Isami Kodaka from Basara and Freedoms. He wrestles for them as well. Hideki Suzuki, the Braham brothers. All these people work for them to fill out their roster when they need them. And they've done some pretty innovative stuff. They were the first guys to use like razor blades and light tubes, because light tubes are cheap.
and they look good.
And they do look good. And there's, you know, they make a nice pop and sparkle and probably carcinogenic, not that good for you. But overall, they're all right. They do things differently. It's kind of like a budget version of a deathmatch company, but they are now, of course, the biggest deathmatch company because all the others no longer work. So by pure sheer will of determination, they have become the biggest deathmatch company in the world. I suppose you could argue CZW is probably a bigger deathmatch company, and some people would suggest that AAA is the biggest of all the deathmatch companies, but there you go.
Well, yeah, I mean, I would, after watching this show, I would argue that it's sort of on the same level as a CZW.
Yeah, I would say that.
Sort of production-wise and sort of size-wise, it seems about that same sort of level.
Yeah, I would argue that technical wrestling is probably better.
Mm.
And there's probably some more character work that is quite good too in this. Not that it's all bad, but yeah.
I think that may just come from the sort of available talent pool for freelancers in Japan compared to the sort of overabundance of, I don't know,
bleeding and screaming guys.
The type
yes.
you get for your deathmatch shows in America.
Mullet, sleeveless t-shirt, grimace, terrible tattoos.
Which we saw some of on this show. Maybe not the tattoos, but we definitely saw some hair.
Yes, definitely. There was some glorious hair. Some beautiful hair. We have to mention how great the hair was, because the hair was just ace. Anyway, we'll get to some of the hair later. Also on this weekend, the boys and girls of Fight Club Pro were in town for their show at Currican Hall on the following Monday after Wrestle Kingdom. So there was a lot of familiar scenes, familiar faces from the British wrestling scene. I also watched the 5th of January show, which featured a main event with your CCK there. And they were in fine form. They had a bit of a cracker, so I recommend the 5th as well. But we're going to concentrate on the 4th. So this was what was happening in Tokyo before Wrestle Kingdom. Okay, this is at Shinkaba First Ring, this is the first time we've looked at Shinkaba First Ring show, which I'm really excited about, because Shinkaba First Ring is such a brilliant idea. Shinkaba First Ring is a wrestling theater. It's all it does is wrestling. It seats about 400 people. It's laid out to have a wrestling show and nothing else. That's all it runs there all week. And they run shows morning, noon, and night all week long. And if you're really poor, you can stay there, as cheerleader Melissa did. She slept there on some of her Japanese tours. So, yeah. So, you know, Shinkaba First Ring is a bit of a... It's kind of like... I was thinking, I said the other week, like the smaller companies see it as their bread and butter hall. If you can fill Shinkaba, you're doing a good job. It's kind of like their TV taping hall, whereas Currican Hall's the big show. Like, that's their equivalent to the Tokyo Dome for like New Japan Pro Wrestling or Raigoku for Noah or for All Japan Pro Wrestling. So, yeah, this is an important venue in the history of Japanese wrestling, which has seen some cool, cool stuff down the years. But we'll start with our first match, which was kind of a young boys kind of match. Takuku Kato and Akira Hayodo in 8 minutes in a very passable kind of beginner's wrestling match. They've all both been around for about a year. Akira is 23 years old. Takuho is 21 years old. They both trained in the BJW dojo. What did you think?
I thought this was all right, actually, yeah. I mean, you said it was sort of a young boy match, and it sort of fit that mold where... Obviously, there wasn't anything too mind-blowing here. There weren't your light tubes and everything here. It was a standard straight match. A lot of sort of fighting to sort of get a Boston Crab and maintain that Boston Crab. And that was sort of the story of the match, was the two fighting back and forth, trying to get the submission on each other. And that led to, in the end, Kato winning with a Boston Crab. I thought it was good, though. I thought both guys looked, you know, they looked the part, and they had some decent movement to them. Hyodo at one point hit a really nice sort of snap Samoan drop, which was cool. And yeah, it was pretty decent for a nice opening match. I thought, just starting off the show here, I thought there was an interesting thing that I noticed was, well, you couldn't really help but notice it. Throughout the show, on the stream that I saw at least, they had a picture-in-picture of the commentator in the bottom right-hand corner the whole time.
Yeah.
Which is an interesting idea. I mean, and this may show my sort of lack of knowledge around Big Japan, is that I get the feeling that the commentator for this show was a wrestler and had some sort of link to what was going on this show.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, I couldn't tell you who it was or what that link is. But I like the sort of the idea of having a commentator visible and actually being able to see the reactions as well as hearing them. So yeah, as for this match though, pretty decent.
That was the actual commentator was Toshiaki Sakuda. And he, I'm trying to think now, where is he? Is he, which division is he in? Sakuda. No, he's a freelancer, I think. Yeah. He's a freelancer. He may have retired, of course, recently as well, as he's a commentator these days. And if you've just looked him up on your Twitter, don't look him up on your Google there, and there's major pictures of him getting his head kicked in all over the place in Noah in BJW.
Oh, okay, there you go then.
So there you go. Yeah. But anyway, yeah. I also, the picture on the front of the video was him as well. When you freeze frame the video and it comes up, so
right,
it must have been presented by him or booked by him possibly as well. But yeah, it was a perfectly good match. It was kind of like a Young Boys match, kind of thing we'd expect from New Japan Pro Wrestling, really, and kind of presented in a very similar way. And you're right with the production as well. All of these shoots were a one-camera shoot, so you kind of missed a few bits of the action, which we'll probably get to later, which was mildly annoying. But this is kind of their live feed. It isn't their final DVD presentation. It'd be interesting to see what they changed. So it just kind of like was the hard camera moving around a bit. But it was perfectly good watchable pro wrestling. And because it's in a smaller venue, you're not going to miss that much anyway, are you? We'll move on then to the six-man tag match, which featured Kota Sekifudi, Shinobu, Tasuhiko Yoshino, and they defeated Kazuki Hashimoto, Yuki Ishikawa, and Yuya Aoki in 9 minutes and 41 seconds in a thoroughly fun junior heavyweights kind of affair. What did you think of this, Alex?
Yeah, so Hashimoto is the BJW Junior Heavyweight Champion. So that pretty much gave you the tone of this match, where it was a junior match with a lot of, you know, quick flying around and a lot of very fast-paced action that was actually very enjoyable. I liked Shinobu as a heel. He seemed to stand out as being quite good as a heel in this match. And his work, especially with Ishikawa selling, was really quite enjoyable. Early on, there was some cool submission work from Sekifuda, who he did a sort of he did a mixed armbar leg bar submission, which looked really cool, and then transitioned into a few different holds from that. Aoki hit a really nice sort of flip over the ropes into a springboard drop kick, which was really nice to see.
Yeah,
there were just some really nice sort of that sort of style of wrestling here, ending with Shinobu hitting a really big frog splash on Ishikawa for the win. And it seemed like Ishikawa was another sort of young boy kind of character. He seemed to take the heat quite a lot in this match. Most of the match was just him getting beaten up and then pinned in the end. But it was fun. It was good.
I was just watching it in the corner of my eye, and he's just taking a massive drop kick to the face.
But to be fair, he also delivered a really nice big drop kick to someone else's face later on in the match. So
yeah. It was 9 minutes 20. It's kind of thing you'd expect. I don't like comparing stuff. I've been told off for doing this before, but I have to compare it because we're trying to give you an idea of what it's like and whether you want to watch it or not. So it's kind of like watching the Suzuki Gun Juniors versus the Regular Army Juniors in New Japan Pro Wrestling. That's kind of roughly give you an idea.
Yeah, it's sort of your sort of standard junior undercard match where you're going to see some good stuff in there, but it's not going to be your sort of main event level junior match.
No, exactly. But it was, yeah, it was solid. There was some solid stuff. There was good mix around. It wasn't the same thing over and over again. Yeah, it was just good, really. The next match was a strong BJ match, because the tag team Strong BJ were in it, but the division Strong BJ was there as well. So Strong BJ had Daisuke Sekimoto and Yuji Okibayashi, and they tagged with Ryuichi Kawakama and Okami, the tag team of Okami, Daichi Hashimoto, Hideyoshi Kamatini, and Takeyue Nomura, lost in 9 minutes and 20 seconds. Again, this was kind of like your standard heavyweight six-man match you'd probably get in something like New Japan as well. But it kind of showcased Sekimoto and Obayashi. And Strong BJ are a cracking tag team, and Sekimoto gets an awful lot of reviews. A certain person we don't mention on this program said his dream this year was to wrestle Sekimoto this morning on Twitter. I hope he doesn't. Anyway, yeah, this was an interesting match, and it's kind of like the standard set by the Strong BJ style, which doesn't really kind of fit in with Strong style or King's Road. Remember, this company's 24 years old, and they've certainly taken their own path because they've evolved, they've got away from death matches, they've kind of created their own groove, and it's a really kind of interesting way of going about things, I think. What did you think of this, Alex?
Yeah, I quite liked it, and I've just got to start by saying, Strong BJ.
Indeed.
Best tag team name around.
Strong Big Japan, obviously.
Yes, well. So we spoke about the sort of the two divisions, and Sekimoto is actually the Strong World Heavyweight Champion. So he's the champion of the sort of Strong style division of Big Japan. And I think he looked good in this match. He stood out as someone who is a big star in this company. And obviously, if you've watched any Japanese wrestling outside of New Japan, Sekimoto has probably popped up somewhere because he seems to just freelance and pop up all over the place all the time.
Yeah.
So, seen him around before and quite like him, so I was happy to see him on this show. I think of everyone so far on this show, Sekimoto and Hashimoto stood out as the two guys who look the part and have the sort of the best big wrestler man looks of anyone there.
Yeah.
And speaking of looks, Hashimoto is our first example of hair, where he seemed to have basically just stolen Sanada's haircut.
Yes, yes, I would agree there. Yeah, let's be honest. There's a lot of stuff going on with that haircut, isn't there?
Yeah. So you've got your big blonde mohawk mullet combination thing, which it was nice to see. But yeah, this was a pretty standard sort of heavyweight tag match where you've got your big moves, your big power guys in there, and you get what it is. It's good. It's enjoyable. It's nice to see big men fighting.
Just going to remember, it was Nomura that was throwing the kicks, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
Yeah, watching Nomura is really impressive because it's kind of like a throwback to guys like Josh Barnett, and you know, kind of like really rough and ready MMA style guys, not crisp to people like Hashimoto, like Shibata or Suzuki. Somebody just throwing kicks really hard.
Yeah, and just throwing these massive kicks at Okabayashi, and Okabayashi just no selling him completely.
Yeah, he kind of reminded me of Takayama a bit, like the old school kind of hardcore. It's not going to be crisp, it's not going to be pretty, but by God, he's going to get the job done. Kind of deal.
He's just going to smack the hell out of them until they go down.
Yeah.
And yeah, that was pretty much his part in this match, was just, let's just keep hitting them as hard as I can. Oh no, they've not been damaged at all. Oh no, now I'm getting picked up into a torture rack.
Again.
But actually, the finish of this match was quite cool, actually. So Okabayashi gets the torture rack on Nomura, which Nomura then reverses, slips out of it into a sleeper hold.
Yeah.
Which then Okabayashi then powers up and sort of powers his way back into a torture rack for the win, which I thought was a really nice little sequence to end the match there.
Yeah, it was just cool. I just like this match. And you also have to say, like, you know, the Strong BJ guys have got a real influence of what the younger guys look like. Because if you go back to that first match with Kaito and Hayato, they look like junior versions of Sekimoto and Okabayashi.
Either they're sort of that big bulky look.
Yeah, either they're hiring like for like only, or they're getting to the dojo and going, you know what, I'm going to do some work on my shoulders and everything above the waist. The legs can be fine, just everything above the waist. I need to look like a house. So, yeah, I think that might be what's happening. But, yeah, very interesting kind of like, but it kind of suits, and it's different to, like, the standard Japanese wrestling body you see. The kind of guy I would say is a standard Japanese wrestling body today is kind of Ishii, Tenzan, that kind of tree trunk upper body, big wide shoulders, big broad neck kind of deal. And this is even more top heavy around the neck and the shoulders as a standard body shape. It's really interesting to see how wrestlers evolve in different companies. So
it's true. And it works for this company as well, where you've got this strong division, which is your power guys. That's the sort of look and the sort of body build that works for that style.
Yeah, definitely. Now, next up, we had Yasufumi Nakone defeating Kazumi Kikoto, according to Cage Match. But that wasn't quite the whole story. Do you want to give the other names that were in this team's, Alex? Because it actually was a straight-up tag match.
It was actually a tag match. And unfortunately, I couldn't find the name of Kikuta's partner. But Nakanoe was teamed with Rota Hammer. And actually, they are the BJW Tag Team Champions. Kikuta, though, he seems to be part of this weird faction where it's him and you've got Kikuta, who looks sort of like Jado but wearing a gi. Then you've got his partner, and then you've got this sort of big sumo guy wearing this sparkly glitter coat who just sat in the crowd the whole time.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure what that was about. Interesting. And this match was, I don't know, it was all right. Hammer is someone I wasn't really a fan of. He just seemed to not really be able to do much at all. He was just sort of, his thing is, he stands there while the guy hits him, and that's it.
Yeah, I mean, Ryota Hammer 10 years ago, when I really got back into Japanese wrestling and started finding things to go look for, he was tagging with Akebono in All Japan Pro Wrestling, and he was kind of given the charge of looking after Akebono and making him good.
Right.
If you see what I mean. And he did. And, they were All Asian Tag Team Champions a couple of times, and then they won win the World Tag Team Championships in All Japan. And Hammer was a good wrestler, but he was about 70 pounds lighter than he is now, and he could move. And now he cannot move.
His high spot of the match was rolling over Kikuta for the pin.
I mean, even a couple of years ago, he was on a Wrestle 1 card, one of the Wrestle 1 versus Impact Wrestling cards when they had their talent swap agreement when they,
Yeah, he wrestled EC3,
yeah,
didn't he?
Yeah, and it was a pretty good match as well. It was solid, but it doesn't take long. When you're that size, it doesn't take long for the wheels to come off, and the wheels have most certainly come off, and I hope he's okay and he manages to lose some weight because he's not going to do his health any good whatsoever.
No, so, yeah, this was fine, but any time that Ryota Hammer was in the ring, I was just not really into it.
No, it's somewhat sad, to be honest with you. It's really not nice to watch somebody get exploited this way, and he really should. I mean, the trouble is, it's part of his gimmick, and everyone tells him it's okay. You know, we've seen it happen so many times before with guys like this who are, it's your gimmick. I've got to do it. I've got to be like this size all the time. And it's like, no, you really don't have to.
It's true, but in the same vein, you look at someone like The Big Show in WWE, where his gimmick is he's big, but he got to a point where he was too big and it was unhealthy and it wasn't working for him. He couldn't perform at the level that he was capable of. And so he went away and he lost the weight and came back looking even better. He's still big, but he's big in a way that works and actually allows him to perform.
And physically far stronger than he ever has been in his life, and he was already freakishly strong to start with.
Exactly, and so I think Ryota Hammer could do with that same sort of change. Step away, lose the weight, and obviously not all of it. It's still...
Yeah.
It's a good gimmick to have, if that's what you are, but there's a point where it goes a bit too far.
Yes, this is not healthy at this particular point. The actual match itself was all right. It did what it said on the tin, and it kind of got everybody over in the way it should have done. And Hammer did his spots, and that was it, really.
Yeah, I mean, Kikuta sold nicely for him, and Nakanoe was good. Hit a nice big lariat to end the match, which was good. So, yeah.
All right, then, we move on to the first of the death matches for the evening. Jackie Numizawa and Kyo Megami defeated Minoru Fujita and Yoichichi Taniguchi in 9 minutes and 26 seconds. There was a bit of a press conference halfway through, and then we got into the death matches. And we did have our first most glorious of mullets, did we not?
So. Oh, boy. So this is where the most deathmatch-looking wrestlers you'll ever see come out
to
the ring.
But not in a bad way. Can we say that?
No, not in a bad way.
No.
I mean, I wasn't prepared for what I was about to see here. So it's a barbed wire board tag team deathmatch, which, you know, you know what you're expecting from that.
Yeah, it does what it says in the tin, really. Yes.
Exactly. And Fujita and Taniguchi come out to the ring, and I just have in my notes, these two are the most deathmatch-looking wrestlers you're ever going to see. My next point in my notes is, holy fuck, I spoke too soon. Because out comes Q Megami and Jackie Numazawa. Megami, oh my, that hair and those shorts.
Right, okay. Kayumi Mogami essentially has Ricky Morton's hair. And I'm not talking like, I'm honestly, it looks like he scalped him. But it obviously he's younger and it's lusher and it's longer and the mullet is higher at the front. But it is essentially Ricky Morton's hair just transplanted onto a Japanese man's head whilst wearing a pair of trash bag shorts that are the most deathmatchy thing you've ever seen. I shared a picture of this gentleman yesterday whilst I was looking at it for Mullet Watch. If you follow the Troopany Show or me, Sheriff Lone Star, you know me, Chelsea, Cy, Tony from the Mike Freeland Wrestling Rewind podcast, and Christy do this thing called Mullet Watch. And whenever we come across a mullet, we share it amongst ourselves for everyone to enjoy. And Chelsea's response was, but doesn't it get caught in the barbed wire? And I was like, apparently it's snag-free hair. It is really well groomed. He looks after it clearly with good hair conditioner because it just glides through. If anything, he moves faster with a mullet.
It's true. It seems to give him his power.
It does. And, you know, by the way, Fujita and Taniguchi are not slow coaches when it comes to the hairstyles, are they?
No. They still had the look. but they were just upstaged. And then you got Numazawa in there with this sort of juggalo face paint as well. I'm not sure how old he is, but he looks like an old man in juggalo face paint.
Numazawa has been wrestling forever.
Yeah. He looked like it, but not in a bad way, but he looked like he's been around for a while.
Let's just find out. Let's see exactly what it is. But yeah, I can remember like early BJ. I think he trained young Kasai, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah, he's 41.
Oh, really?
Yeah. 18 years. His Technica hardcore deathmatch, Black Angel, Jackie Numazawa. Yeah, he debuted in 2000. And he was a judo player in his youth.
Okay.
Yeah, so, you know, he's actually probably a genuine badass. but he has such a kind of iconic look of the... if you think of a BJW wrestler, you're thinking of Numazawa, really, aren't you?
Yeah, I think when I spoke at the start of the show about sort of what my stereotypical view of Big Japan would be, I think it's probably him I was picturing.
Yeah, and probably Young Kasai in his days from Big Japan Pro Wrestling. Actually, we should mention Young Kasai. Young Kasai did start in Big Japan Pro Wrestling, but he became such a big star with his style because he was the first real aerial deathmatch wrestler. He kind of outgrew the company. He had to start his own in Freedoms, which I thought was really interesting because it's kind of launched Freedoms as a company as well, this particular company. They all work together and they're all still friends, but yeah. Kasai kind of like separated himself off. Also, shout out, is it Taniguchi or Fujita who has the half blonde, half black hair?
That was Fujita.
That's the side mullet, which is just phenomenal. So rarely seen these days.
rare specimen.
Yeah, layered and lethal. It's just fantastic. The actual wrestling match, by the way, is also very, very good.
Yes, it was.
Because these guys know what they're doing, clearly. There is a right way and a wrong way to do deathmatch styles, and these guys are doing it the right way. Nothing looked ridiculously painful, even though they were rummaging around in the barbed wire boards all the time, and clearly all of them are going to bleed before the end. But there's quite a heavy feud going on between these two teams, and it kind of felt like the finish of something, or at least the start of something big. one of my kind of qualms with deathmatch wrestling of this particular style, not so much with the FMW wing stuff, because to me it's just all environment, is it can seem contrived, especially with the matches that they have in BJW, where there are things that are obviously set up for certain spots to happen. And this didn't feel like this. It felt like a natural flow, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, I thought this match worked quite well. I mean, 10 seconds into the match, Taniguchi was already bleeding. So that pretty much sums that up.
Because of course he was.
But yeah, you're right. Overall, there wasn't too much of the sort of ridiculous just violence for the sake of it.
Yeah.
It all sort of fit with some sort of story and it worked quite well. And I think up to this point, this was the match that had the crowd sort of most interested. They were really, really into Numazawa.
Yeah.
And everything he did got a really good reaction. So this actually was, it worked really well. I liked it. There were a couple of moments in there where there were some pretty cool moves with Numazawa. He did sort of a fake out punch, which Fujita ducked, and then he just grabbed him and hit a DDT. I thought that was a really nice little spot there.
Though, bizarrely, whilst I'm watching it, that's exactly what happened.
Really?
You called it just perfectly as it happened on the video in my corner. It's like you did color commentary for me, Alex. Or play-by-play, I should say. That was awesome. Yeah. Sorry to interrupt.
But there was another bit with Taniguchi. Really impressive. He did sort of... So Undertaker's old school, the sort of tightrope walk across the top rope. But he did it from one corner of the ring all the way across one side and then across the other side to the opposite corner before getting countered. It was really impressive to see a guy just tightrope walk the whole way around. And yeah, it showed some talent.
It does, yeah. I mean, all of these guys can go, but they're not the best looking folks, let's be blunt. As far as like body image is concerned and facial features are concerned, they don't have that natural charisma that, say, someone like Sanada does or, say, like Naito does. They do have a natural charisma. It just doesn't appeal to as many people as, say, Kazuchika Okada does. Do you see what I mean?
True. But if you think about the style of wrestling that they're doing, it works for that style.
Yeah, yeah. As
they look like people who would genuinely be able to beat you up. They look like the type of people who would actually grab a barbed wire board and hit you with it.
Oh, it's like when Joey Styles, when they were doing the one night only pay-per-views in WWE the first year, and there was Dudley's versus Dreamer and Sandman, and there was all the interference stuff and people doing ridiculous bumps everywhere, and Joey Styles just said, it looks like a prison break in here. This is essentially what it looks like, you know. These guys would be doing time if it wasn't for wrestling. That's what it looks like. But it works really, really well for this particular environment. And these guys, they're all trying 110% on everything they do. Because this is a regular house show for them. And we're not the main event yet. And we've got barbed wire board tag matches, you know. So
Yeah. And it, you know, it worked for them. They're good at what they do. And you can tell they've been doing this style for a long time. They know all the ins and outs of it, and they know how to best get a reaction from the crowd for what they do.
Yeah, definitely. Right then, we move on to the next match, which was Third Generation Chimodo Brothers, Masaya Takahashi and Taika Ueki versus Kanakuro Hoshino, Ryuichi Sakine, who they took the loss in their particular matchup. What did you think of this one?
So we spoke a minute ago about how the last match was not contrived in any way, and how it didn't seem to be stuff for the sake of it. This match sort of went the other way.
This was contrived.
So the first shot you see of the ring before anyone comes out is in one corner you've got a stepladder, and in the other corner you've got a pile of concrete blocks.
Yes. We'll point out that the stepladder is the regular ring stepladder that just gets you into the ring.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But right away you know that, and oh, right, I forgot to say, by this point as well, because we're into the deathmatch half of the show, in each of the corners, there's just a stack of chairs.
Yes, underneath each tag rope corner. And this is a regular tag match. So obviously, you know, you've got plenty of room for people, so it's not so bad. But, you know, if it was a six-man, there'd just be not enough room for people to stand on the corner because there's that many chairs under there.
Which makes me wonder, because the third generation Chimidora brothers, which is another good tag team name.
It is.
are the company's six-man tag champions. And it makes me wonder if they're doing this style for their matches, how that works, as you just said, with fitting everyone around the ring.
Well, they did wrestle with their partner, Ricky Shane Page, Drew Parker, and Jimmy Havoc on the next night. And that seemed to flow, but they did spend a lot of time just tornado-style brawling. It wasn't quite so organized.
Well, when you think about it, actually, because do you know the name of the of Big Japan's six-man tag team championships? Do you know the full name of the titles?
They are the
Yokohama Shopping Street six-man tag team championships.
There you go. Are they sponsored?
I'm not sure, actually. I didn't get a good enough look at the belts to be able to see if there was some sort of logo on there, but...
Let's have a look. As the name suggests, the title is usually defended in the Yokohama Shopping Street area.
So...
Yeah, right, it says...
is that sort of outside deathmatch brawls or something that...
Yeah, here it says, the Yokohama Shopping Street Six-Man Tag Team Championship is a professional wrestling trios championship owned by Big Japan Pro Wrestling. As the name suggests, the title is usually defended on the Yokohama Shopping Street area. Bear in mind that Big Japan's office is in Yokohama. The title was first announced in May 2012. The first champions were crowned with a team of Kazuki Hashimoto, Takumi Sakamoto, and Yuji Okibayashi, defeated Yoshihito Sasaki, Shinya Ishikawa, and Masa Otani in a six-man tag team match. And yes, let's see, they were all defended in Yokohama up until... For the first 3 years, they only defended the championships in Yokohama. Then they let them go around the country.
Oh, okay.
But just to add to the confusion, the current champions, the third generation Chimodo brothers, won this in the Man Sacred Ground City of Forest Sendai tournament.
I think that sounds like something we need to review in the future.
They won them in the semi-final, and presumably they defended them successfully in the final. So I'm guessing... During BJW tournaments, championships are live. So there you go.
Well, speaking of overbooked and contrived, let's get back to this match.
Yes. See, BJW do things differently. They're none of this booking about with like... It was like... I'll give you an example from my work life. You guys know working in a school. And I was asking the kids before Christmas, use your imagination, draw out anything you want, as a two-part story. It doesn't have to be too complicated, but if you want to make it as complicated as you want, you can do. And then I do, like, me walking to work, me getting up in the morning. So, of course, I got 32 me walking to work, school, me getting up in the morning things. But one of them was, what's this? It's unicorns invading Mars. And I went, brilliant, that's what I want. And this is that wrestling. It's wrestling an eight-year-old would think up in a good way.
I mean, I'd be... shocked if an eight-year-old was watching this, but yes, I get what you mean.
Yeah, not the actual violence part, but like, you know, it's cartoon violence in this way, and this kind of match is cartoon violence. I'm not so keen on this style because, like you said, it is contrived, and a bunch of spots happen because a bunch of spots happen, and there is literally a section in this match where somebody lays out some bricks.
Yeah, there was so the spot where they've got, I think they had Hoshino laying on the floor and they stacked the concrete blocks around his face and over his face and then grabbed a sledgehammer and smashed concrete blocks over his face for a two count.
This is the other trouble. In the previous match, people actually sold hardcore stuff properly. Yes. You know, getting nearly hit in the face with a sledgehammer, as Eddie Edwards proved when Sammy Callahan nearly blinded him earlier this year, is not going to do you much good. So a two count is probably a bit sharp, really. I think it probably should have been three. If he got saved, then fair enough, but he wasn't getting saved, was he?
I mean, to be fair, it was close to the end. I think they went from that spot to then a jackhammer for the win, but yeah.
But it is slightly worrying that regular wrestling moves are more powerful than, like...
having a concrete block smashed over your face. Oh, and earlier in the match, where he had a concrete block smashed over his balls for a two count.
Yes, that was... using I think probably a 10 kilo weight and smashing that into the bruise block that was set into his testicles.
So that's this match.
Yeah, in a the what's up that even the Dudleys would wince at. Yes.
But that being said, though,
yes,
Hoshino was definitely very over with the crowd.
Yes.
And the crowd were into what was going on. So from that perspective, it was actually all right. And it was what the crowd wanted to see. I mean, it was different from the other stuff on the show.
Yeah.
But it worked for the crowd. That, I mean, you had your spots like that, or your spot like where Ueki just headbutted a chair for no reason. Yeah. And it didn't really do anything. But
one spot I'm looking at the minute, and the one that just drives me nuts, is side Russian leg sweeps onto obstacles. Why?
Yeah,
you're
so
gonna hurt yourself
onto a onto concrete blocks where you're actually throwing yourself onto concrete blocks as well.
Yeah, because you land first on a side Russian leg sweep. That doesn't make any sense. Yeah. So, but yeah.
So there was that stuff in there, but it worked for the crowd. The crowd liked it. And because of the crowd reactions to Hoshino especially, it did work and it was somewhat enjoyable.
Yes. It was really, really good from that point of view. But I mean, yeah, I could watch it and it was okay, but it kind of like washed over me because I was out at the moment after the first couple of spots. But yes. Something that was better, though, was Crazy Lovers, Masahashi Takeda and Takumi Tsukamoto, as they defeated your British contingent of Drew Parker and Ricky Shane Page in 13 minutes and 15 seconds in a Light Tubes Tag Team Death Match, which all started out with a handshake because they were going to have a nice sporting affair. which I kind of laughed at, which was just good, which made me smile because it was like, that's brilliant, you know. But what did you think of this one, Alex?
I thought this was actually the best match on the show. I really liked this. So shout out to Drew Parker for his fantastic hair as well. I just really liked the Crazy Lovers as a team. I liked, so they first come out and they're announced as Crazy Lovers, and I'm instantly obviously reminded of Golden Lovers and thinking, right, who's the Kenny, who's the Kota, who's doing what? But they were so over with the crowd. The crowd loved everything they did. And a lot of the stuff they did was really cool. I mean, obviously, we start off with the handshakes and then everyone just takes a bump on the light tubes just because, you know, showing how hardcore we are. But then, so we get from that to actually a very good match where obviously it's all based around the light tubes in some way, but they actually use them in quite creative ways where it wasn't just, I'm going to smash it over your head now you're going to smash it over mine.
Yeah.
They set up spots in a cool way. They had a cool spot at one point where it was a concerto to Drew Parker with light tubes sort of involved, which was cool. And I said earlier on about how light tubes just look good. And that it showed in this match where whenever a light tube would use, you have the big explosion of all the dust and it looks really impressive. Like at one point where there was a big drop kick by Takeda into the tubes in the corner and there was this massive because it was like 10 light tubes. It was this massive explosion of white dust all over the place. It just looked really cool. I've got to say, I think Ricky Shane Page might have been cheating a bit by wearing a t-shirt in this match. Everyone else is topless, rolling around in his glass, and he's there in a shirt.
Yeah. Well, you know, I personally think he's got a much more sensible approach to life.
Yeah, you're sensible wrestler, Ricky Shane Page.
Yes, bastion of common sense.
But actually, so speaking of him and his sort of his outfit and everything, his size really set him apart in this match, where he's quite a bit bigger than everyone else there. And it actually, at one point, it led to the commentary comparing him to Kevin Owens. Which, yes, I can see those comparisons, and I think it really set him apart to have him looking that different, and it didn't really seem to slow him down at all either. He was still hitting some really impressive offense throughout. So we have later on, towards the end of the match, we have Drew Parker hitting some really, you know, cool looking flips and stuff. There's one point where they do an assisted standing 450 splash where Ricky Shane Page flips him over and he hits a 450 from a standing position, which was cool. He then goes on to take a double team wheelbarrow facebuster into a bunch of light tubes. But yeah, I liked this match. I thought we're now back to, right, there's all these light tubes around, there's all these chairs around. At one point there was a knife there for some reason, but we're going to use them in a creative way and we're actually going to base a wrestling match around these weapons rather than just, oh, there's a bunch of weapons here, so we're going to hit each other with them.
Yeah, it's not, there's no, yeah, this is back to a wrestling reality I can enjoy because I didn't feel it. I had that moments of tension that you used to get in FMW matches where, you know, people are going close to the electrified barbed wire. You have that kind of tension there. And there is the kind of like normalcy of this violence, which kind of an established promotion like this does it really, really well because they've had this normalcy of everything being violent for a long time, which is something FMW never really got used to. Everything was violent, but it was all shock and awe. And that meant a lack of sustainability because what are you going to do when you've finished shocking people? Mm. Whereas this is just tough. You know, it's not ultra, ultra violent. It's violent. I would not recommend this to anyone under the age of 18. But, you know, this is not as ridiculous as it possibly could be. This is level down. And it's much more approachable, if we can say that.
Definitely. It's conceivable that this stuff would happen if it was a real fight, and it's based, as you said, in a wrestling reality, which makes it work.
Yeah, definitely. And just, you've got four guys who can really go. You know, Takeda and Sukimoto were brilliant. I loved watching them. I want to see more of those guys.
Yeah, definitely. They really stood out as a really cool team.
Yeah.
And actually, they helped with that sort of making everything make sense, because anytime you did have a crazy spot that seemed a bit off the wall, it was them involved in doing it.
Yeah.
And their gimmick is that they are crazy. And so that makes sense. Obviously, you had at the start where they were taking the bumps on the tubes to show that they're crazy. And at the end, after they won the match, they're slamming each other on top of light tubes because that's what they do.
Yeah. They are the crazy lovers. And it just works. It worked really, really well. And yeah. Props to Drew Park and Ricky Shane Page to go to the other side of the world to bleed a lot for a weekend.
Yeah,
to be honest.
But they didn't look out of place. They looked
definitely not.
They belonged here. So
yeah, they were on. And also when I looked at that show from the 5th, them tagging with Jimmy Havoc is something else I want to see more of as well because they were brilliant together as a threesome. Mm. It was a bit more of a tornado tag style kind of thing, but it worked really, really well. And I'd love to see them tag together again. It's one of those things, I've seen a lot of Jimmy Havoc, but I haven't seen any Drew Parker or Ricky Shane Page, which is really weird, but it's just the confluence of what wrestling I watch from the UK and what people are available where.
Yeah.
So it's like, yeah, it's a bit strange. So it's like I had to wait till they were on the other side of the world before I actually got a chance to see them, but I will be watching more of their stuff because I was very impressed.
Yeah, I've got to say, Drew Parker is someone who is a really interesting prospect. I mean, he's only like, I think he's only like 21 or 22 at the moment. Yeah. He's really young. And so I first saw him, I think maybe 18 months, 2 years ago.
Yeah.
And at the time he was doing a gimmick called EC Drew, where he would basically come out cosplaying as different ECW wrestlers. So he'd come out and he's dressed as Raven, come out and he's dressed as Tommy Dreamer, stuff like that. Now he's evolved. It's becoming more of his own person. And it's really working for him. So I'm glad to see that he has, you know, evolved into his own wrestler. And he's really seems to be doing well for himself at the moment.
Yeah, definitely. This one lasted 30 minutes and 15 seconds. And it was very, very good. And now we get to our main event of the evening. DLC and Bring Your Own Weapons Tag Team Deathmatch with Jimmy Havoc and Ryuji Ito defeating Toshiaki Sakuda and Yuko Miyamoto in 13 minutes and 28 seconds of a thoroughly entertaining affair. What did you think of this one, Alex?
Yeah, it was fun. This was the sort of the thing that drew me to this show and made me want to watch it, is Jimmy Havoc, someone I've seen a lot of over here. And, you know, I've worked a lot of shows with him. I've seen a lot of shows with him. And I just was interested to see how he would get on in a Japanese wrestling environment. The whole gimmick of Bring Your Own Weapon was interesting here, where So Sakura comes out at first with his weapon is a wooden board with nails in it. Right, fine. Makes sense. That's a deathmatch weapon. His partner, Miyamoto, comes out with a gigantic cutout of what looked like the Empire State Building.
Yes.
I'm not sure what, if there was some sort of,
but it was,
you know,
made of
storyline
light
or
tubes,
character
though, wasn't it?
Explanation for that, or
wasn't it made of light tubes though?
It was, yeah. I'm just, why the Empire State Building?
I don't know. It was
strange.
It was a large arrow.
But Jimmy got a laugh out of me when he came out with an 8x10 photo. His weapon that he brought to this match was a piece of paper.
Because we all know what Jimmy does with pieces of paper.
Exactly. And then, yeah, then Ito comes out with the most boring one of all of them, a kendo stick.
But it goes back to the legends, though, a kendo stick, doesn't it?
Exactly. And he made good use of that kendo stick. So, yeah, this match was basically, this was your big brawl, where they went all over the crowd. They were all over the place. And this is where the one camera became a little bit of an issue.
Yeah.
Where
yeah.
there were some points where you couldn't really see what was going on because the camera couldn't quite reach them and see them, and the crowd wasn't really lit very well. And so there were moments where you're just sort of, you're watching a crowd moving out of the way, but you don't really see why they're moving out of the way.
Yeah. Yeah. It suffers from that. But, you know, again, it's like, we got it for free. We shouldn't really complain in one
sense. Well, no. Obviously, not complaining about it at all.
It's just one of them things, isn't it? You know,
it's just one of those things, yeah, to sort of, if you're wrestling at this level with this sort of production, it's one of those things you sort of try to keep in mind that, you know, the camera's there. It would be good if it could see me. But obviously, you know, with this match, with the way they were presenting it, it wasn't really in the forefront of their mind.
No. When it comes to like the DVD presentation, should there be a DVD presentation or a streaming presentation? Because there's BJW Core, should you want to go and find stuff, by the way, if you want more of this. That will probably be a better variation of what you saw here.
Yeah, I would assume that along with that, there'd be some sort of some handheld cameras down near the ring, which would be able to get all of that. So that's fine. But as far as the match itself goes, it was a really fun brawl. It starts off with Jimmy showing off a bit where he hits a big double stomp and a suicide dive, and right away the crowd was into him. I was wondering sort of how much of the crowd would have known him in advance. It seemed like there were at least some people there. Obviously, this was Wrestle Kingdom Day, and so you had a big sort of international presence in the city. Because at one point you heard the Jimmy Havoc chants that you would hear back here in the UK.
Yeah.
And so it seemed like there were at least some traveling fans had gone to this show to see him.
Yeah.
But that sort of opening, that hot opening where he's throwing himself all over the place and hitting these big moves, really got the Japanese crowd into him, which was really a good start to the match.
Yeah, very smart move. Actually, the first thing Bryan Danielson did in Noah on his first match was throw somebody outside and then go and do a tope straight outside.
There you go.
Very
instantly
first
the crowd gets into it.
Yeah, and so he became a massive star in Noah very quickly.
Definitely.
Yeah.
So yeah, we have all the spots you would expect throughout this match. It being a TLC match, at one point Miyamoto does the Terry Funk spot where he's got the ladder around his head and he's spinning all over the place. You've got Jimmy does his paper cut spot to Sakuda's fingers. Later on, he does it to his nose as well.
Yeah.
You have the Empire State Building being smashed over Jimmy's head from the top row. Sakuda was good here. He hit some cool moves. He did a 619 at one point into a moonsault, which was cool. Miyamoto hit a really nice handspring elbow to Ito as well.
There's a lot more technical wrestling in this than you'd actually expect, to be honest.
Exactly,
It's very good technical wrestling as well.
Yeah, it was a cool mix between brawling all over the place and having the weapons there, and then actually, yeah, as you said, some technical stuff in there as well, which really worked. You had Sakuda, a few times he went for this springboard swanton bomb, where he missed it a few times and then hit it in the end. And I thought that was a really cool move that he was doing there, and it worked well with the weapons in the match, where he would have it be onto a ladder or have it with chairs involved or something like that.
Yeah,
it worked quite well. And yeah, it all was a really good brawl, basically, ending with Jimmy hitting a fireman's carry slam onto a nail board on top of chairs and then hitting the acid rainmaker on Sakuda for the win. Yeah. So Jimmy, in his sort of Japanese debut, gets the big win, which is nice.
Bodes well for the future should they want him back, which I think they probably will.
Well, going after the promo, after the match, you have Jimmy gets the microphone first and just does the standard thank you. Then Ito is doing a promo where I could, obviously couldn't understand what he was saying, but I think at some point he said tournament, and then he said something about Jimmy, and the crowd all started chanting for Jimmy. So I don't know what exactly he said, but I'm guessing it was something to do with maybe plans for Jimmy to return in the future.
Well, Jimmy has won the King of Death tournament in CZW. That was 2017. He was King of Death in 2017. Didn't go back to defend it, I don't think. So, you know, if he's going around collecting deathmatch tournaments, this would be a good place to go get one.
I mean, what is Big Japan's big tournament of the year? Do you know?
I don't know. I shall look it up. Give me just a moment. I'm going to go whilst... Well, I'm going to edit this bit out for a start. That's what I'm going to do.
Sorry, I put you on the spot there.
It's all right. I'm trying to see that the Warriors, current tag team, defunct... Tournaments. Funny you should mention that, Alex. there are three tournaments. There's a Saiko Tag League. Saikyo. Saiko Tag League. Current champions are Ryota Hama and Yoshifumi Nakanui. So apparently they are some good. the Ikusoan Deathmatch Survivor Tournament. Current champion is Masaya Takahashi. That was in April of last year. April of 2017, and the Ikutsane Strong Climb Tournament, which was last held on 2016. These are annual tournaments, but those were the last time they were held. So, I don't know. We'll see what, maybe something along those lines. So if they're bringing back the tournaments, bringing back some big international names, we'd probably do BJW some good. We should also point out, like, this weekend's of shows were kind of, like, partly organized by Sendai Girls, because Meiko Satomura obviously wrestles for Fight Club Pro. She is their champion. She helped them organize the big show at Kurikan Hall, but you can't just go over and do one show because it costs too much money to keep people together. There was a load of BJW guys on the Fight Club Pro show, so Jimmy Drew Parker and
Ricky Shane Page
and the Hunter Brothers and CCK went to wrestle for BJW to return the favor. So this is how wrestling works. This is how things work together. If you have a look at Vulture Hound today, specifically the wrestling section, which is run by Steel Chair Magazine, you can find my part in a New Year's wishes for pro wrestling. And my wish was for people to be a bit more like Meiko Satomura and give the best representation of professional wrestling that they can, because once again, Meiko is at the forefront, and she isn't even on this card that we've talked about. So, you know, that's what I'm talking about. Like, make the best of what you've got and what you are. So
yeah, for sure. And it would be nice, actually, to see Big Japan get brought over here, some of the guys get brought over here for some Fight Club Pro shows and keep that relationship going, because I think both companies are going through something of a hot period.
Yeah.
So it'd be nice to see them both working together and capitalizing on that and having a sort of a talent exchange.
Yes, because obviously Fight Club Pro have had a bit of a massive hold for putting their roster lately.
Something like that.
Yes, like their WWE contract. They aren't a WWE contracted company like the others. So they've lost Travis Banks. They've lost Pete Dunne, British Strong Style, and a bunch of others who have signed with the WWE, which means they've got this massive hole in their roster. But not only that, they've lost all their trainers, because the Fight Club Pro School Millie McKenzie used to go to, well, still goes to, she was being taught by Travis Banks and by Pete Dunne and by a bunch of other people who are now signed with the WWE.
Right. So, well, there you go then. Yeah. So there's definitely some vacancies there where you could have, you know, an influx of new talent from Japan and from the rest of the British scene to try and replenish that.
Yeah. Just to have a quick flash through the fifth, because I did go watch the fifth one. There were some good matches on that. I will say, actually, my favourite performance of the entire weekend of both shows that I watched, the Hunter Brothers defeating Kota Sefikuda and Tatsuhiko Yoshino in 11 minutes and 42 seconds. I've watched the Hunter Brothers before, and they're good. They're really good, but they really turned it on. It's like watching a cross between the British Bulldogs and the Royal Brothers. It's like 1983 all over again. But they do it really, really well. And it's like watching this in Japan and like Lee Hunter doing, you know, the Johnny Saint finish spot with the hands and escapes and strings and jump off the rope?
Yeah.
He did that absolutely note perfectly. And it's like, oh my God.
That's really cool.
Yeah, so they were doing
I'm going to have to go and watch that show.
Yeah, they were doing loads of like Royal Brothers tag team stuff and Bulldogs tag team stuff. And it's like they've kind of handpicked the legendary British tag teams from all eras and made it into one team. And that's.
But also, that works well with that audience where,
yeah,
you know, the British Bulldogs in Japan, especially Dynamite Kid in Japan, you know, that's a big deal.
Yeah, definitely. So it was the right thing. And of course, Kazuki Hashimoto and Yuki Aoki getting defeated by CCK was fantastic as well. 14 minutes and 51 seconds. A brilliant, brilliant main event. CCK are doing good stuff, and I just hope Lycos stays fit all year long. Please.
Yeah, it seems like every other month he's got something, so I hope this year he can stick around for the whole year.
Yeah, that would be absolutely brilliant. So, because Lycos is awesome. Right then. What were your thoughts overall on this card there, young Alex? What did you think, and would you watch BJW again?
So I thought as a whole, I really enjoyed this show, actually. It built as the card went on. It started out as your standard sort of undercard Japanese show, but then as it built and then the second half of the show was all the deathmatch stuff, it built quite well, and I actually quite enjoyed a lot of the stuff later on in the show, which I didn't think I would. Aside from the one match with the Chimidora brothers, Hoshino and Sekine, aside from that one with all the concrete blocks and all that stuff, everything else was really good and I enjoyed it. So I think Big Japan is something that I will be definitely keeping a closer eye on going forwards and, you know, making more of an effort to check out their shows throughout this year.
There you go. Right then. Well, I really enjoyed these cards as well, and I think, you know, it's different. I've watched loads of BJW before, more historic stuff, and it's nice to go back to it and see that they're still doing really good, solid wrestling stuff, telling their stories, which is what they're supposed to be doing, and people are making a living doing it, and that's really important. You know, violence may not be your cup of tea, but they're doing a very good job of presenting something that's still not that violent. It's no worse than ECW was. In fact, it's probably tamer than ECW was, I think.
Yeah, I would say so.
Yeah, it's good not family fun wrestling.
It's good family friendly fun.
They do shows that are completely non-deathmatch orientated. I think they do it by colour codes. I can't remember. It's blue and red shows. And like the blue shows are the strong style ones and the red shows are the blood ones, obviously. And then, you know, so if you see the posters or the tickets, you can not go to the one with blood on if you've got children. So that's okay, a good thing.
That's pretty smart marketing, actually.
Yeah, so they're hitting out at two audiences, and then if they need to grab both of them together, they'll put on a big show with them both together. So there you go. Right then. Next week, we're not sure what we're going to do. We may try and go back to the beginner's guide next week, or we might look at Fantasticomania, because we keep missing out Fantasticomania when we never do the shows. And I'm sure Christy would be very keen to do Fantasticomania, I feel. So maybe we'll do Fantasticomania. Or maybe we'll go back to UWFI and try and finish that story, because I would really like to finish that story, because there's only one more chapter to tell. I think it'd be cool. Or maybe we'll find another Japanese promotion. There's some Sendai Girls gone up this month, so maybe we could have a look at that instead. We'll see. Anyway, thank you very much for listening today. I'd like to thank my guest, Mr. Alex Edwards. You can find him Alex_Edwards_ on your Twitter there.
Thank you for having me, and I'm looking forward to seeing even more different kinds of wrestling throughout this year. It'll be interesting to see where we go next.
This year, we will be different. Lots of different. I would like to thank you for listening. You can find us at Troopany Show on Twitter. You can find us on Patreon at The Troopany Show and Facebook at Troopany Show. Please go to our Patreon. Keep The Troopany Show free forever for everyone. And we'll speak to you soon. Oh, you can listen to Mike Freeland's Wrestling Rewind later in the week with his guest. I don't know who is the guest this week. It'll be someone entertaining. You should go back and listen to last week's, because it was Tony and Mike, and they were really, really funny together. And they did talk about some serious interests in serious issues concerning mental health as well. So it's not always fun and games. But thank you very much for listening to them. Thank you very much for listening to us. We'll see you soon. Take care and have a good week. Bye.